Usually we talk about the 1970s on this show. We're talking about disco or Watergate, maybe the gas crisis in the US. We have a very, a very American-centric view of that decade.
Right, bell bottoms, malaise, and long lines at the pump.
Exactly. But I want you to mentally travel with me for a second. Drop the disco ball. It is 1973. You are 19 years old. You've just gotten off a plane, maybe for the first time in your life, and then a train. You're heading north. And I don't mean Minnesota north. I mean you are skimming the absolute edge of the Arctic Circle.
To a place where the geography itself, the environment, feels like it's actively trying to kill you.
Yes. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and the sun is already setting. You're wearing this polyester suit that is functionally completely useless against the wind, and you're carrying a suitcase full of religious texts written in a language that J.R.R. Tolkien actually used as the basis for Elvish because it was so complex.
And you're surrounded by people who have just spent the last 30 years rebuilding their entire country from the ashes of World War II, living constantly in the shadow of the Soviet Union. They are tough, they are skeptical, and they definitely didn't ask you to come.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are unpacking a fascinating, really specific slice of history. We're looking at a collection of oral histories, journals, and memoirs from American missionaries.
Specifically from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Right, and they were all serving in fill-in during the 1970s.
It's a genre of history that I think often gets overlooked. We usually look at the theology, what did they preach? But these documents, they aren't really about theology. They're about collision.
Solution, what do you mean by that?
Cultural collision. You have these optimistic, maybe slightly naive American teenagers colliding head-on with the sisu, the grit of post-war Finland.
I'm really glad you brought up Sisu. I saw that word all over the source material. It seems like you can't understand fill-in without understanding that word.
You really can't. Sisu is.
Right.
It's a Finnish word that doesn't have a direct English translation. It's not just courage. It's stoic determination.
Okay.
It's the guts to keep fighting when you've already lost. And you have to understand, the Finland these missionaries walked into was absolutely defined by this. They had fought the Winter War against Russia.
Right.
They lost territory. They had paid these massive, crushing war reparations. The national psyche was one of survival.
So into this atmosphere of hardened survivalism walks a 19-year-old kid from, say, Utah, named Elder Smith, who wants to talk about joy and new revelation.
Talk about a hard sell. I mean, it's almost absurd when you frame it like that.
And that's really our mission for this deep dive. We aren't here to debate the doctrine. Whether you're religious or not, honestly, that's not the point today. The point is the human experience. We want to look at the resilience required to survive minus 40-degree weather on a bicycle. We want to look at the missionary persona, that strange mix of absolute authority and total vulnerability.
And we're going to look at the ripple effects. Because what struck me again and again in these journals is how these tiny, small actions, a song played on a piano, a decision to not attend a concert, just a single prayer, how they echoed forward for 40 years.
We've got stories that, I'm not kidding, sound like they were ripped from a movie script. We have missionaries literally tackling prison escapees in the snow.
Which is a sentence I never thought I'd say.
Right. We have rumors of CIA espionage, and we have this incredible family saga, the Honkonen family, that reads like a multi-generational novel.
The Honkonen story is the anchor. I think if you really want to understand the heart of this entire era, you have to understand that family.
Well, let's not keep everyone waiting. Let's head to the land of the midnight sun and midday darkness.
Let's do it.
So let's start with the people, because, history is just maps and dates until you put a face on it. And the face of this deep dive, in so many ways, is the Honkonen family.
Right. And to understand the Honkonens in the 1970s, the source material actually forces us to go back further. We have to go back to the aftermath of the war.
This is that backstory of unfulfilled promises that's mentioned in the memoirs.
It is, exactly. The Honkonens were refugees. They were from Karelia. Now, for those who don't know their Nordic geography, Karelia was a significant region of Finland that was ceded to the Soviet Union after World War II.
So just imagine that. You lose your home, your land, your entire context, your history, and you're forced to move west into the remaining parts of Finland. That's the baseline trauma here.
It's a massive national and personal trauma. They are displaced. But there's this specific tragedy that hangs over the father side of the family. The father of our main characters, the Honkonen sisters, his father had a brother.
Okay, the great uncle.
Let's just call him the uncle to keep it simple. Before the war, this uncle had made a vow, a promise. He promised to fund his brother's education. He was going to pay for him to go to school, to lift the whole family up. It was seen as the way out.
The ticket to the middle class, a better life.
And then the war came. The brother, the one who was supposed to get the education, Mariti was his name, he was killed in action.
Oh, no.
He died, and that promise of education, that dream, it died with him. It's this ghost of what could have been that haunts the family.
That's a heavy shadow to live under, that idea that we were supposed to be something else, that our destiny was stolen from
us. That's precisely. But here is where the ripple effect starts, decades before our story even begins. Years later, the uncle's daughter, so the cousin of the Honkonen sisters, she knows about this broken promise.
Okay.
She knows the family debt that was never paid, so she decides to balance the ledger.
How does she do that?
She reaches out to Ermeli Honkonen, one of the sisters. At the time, Ermeli is living in the countryside, likely with very limited prospects. And the cousin offers her a job as a nanny in Helsinki.
She gets her out of the village and into the big city.
She fulfills the spirit of the promise, not the original one, but she provides the opportunity for education and advancement to the next generation. This move is the absolute catalyst. If Ermeli doesn't go to Helsinki, none of the rest of this ever happens.
So Ermeli is in Helsinki. It's the swinging 60s, early 70s. She's young. She's away from home for the first time. And the sources say she starts searching. Is that fair?
She's spiritually restless. And this is so interesting. Her conversion doesn't start with a sermon or a pamphlet. It starts with art. She's writing poetry.
Really?
She's writing songs. The journals mention titles like Guide My Life and Best Friend. She is articulating a deep need for connection before she even knows who or what she's trying to connect to.
That feels very modern, you know, that spiritual but not religious vibe, until she finds the container for it.
And when she finds it, in this case, the message brought by these American missionaries, she dives in completely. Yeah. But this is where we see the social network effect. This is pre-Facebook, pre-Instagram. The network was literal blood relatives. It was her sisters.
The domino effect.
It's a perfect domino effect. Ermeli finds faith, and her immediate, overwhelming instinct is, I need to get Lena, her sister.
Now, I read this part of the notes, and I have to ask. This is a little manipulative. The source talks about something called a prayer experiment.
It does skirt the line, doesn't it, from a modern perspective. Ermeli and a group of young people at a Bible Institute decide to focus their spiritual energy. They pick one person to pray for, intensely, and Ermeli picks Lena.
It sounds a bit like spiritual targeting.
From the outside, you could absolutely see it that way. But from their perspective, it was an act of desperate love. They believed this was the only way to help her. And the timing is, well, it's spooky. The source claims that the very next day, after this prayer circle started, Lena shows up.
She just appears out of the blue.
She shows up on the doorstep, and she's broken. She'd been dealing with some serious heartache disappointment. She was at a real low point in her life. And because she was at that low point, she was porous. She was open to the message Ermeli had. It found her at the exact moment of need.
So you have Ermeli, then Lena, and then the domino hits the third sister, Tarja. Now, Tarja's story, this one felt different to me. This wasn't just heartache. This was a legal drama.
Tarja's story is intense. She was the victim of identity theft, which is something we think of as a very 21st century problem. But in the 70s, someone had used her personal information to make purchases.
Wow.
She was in debt for things she didn't buy. She was being crushed by this financial deception, and she felt completely powerless.
And the sisu kicks in.
With a spiritual boost, the sisters pray for her. And Tarja finds this newfound courage. She actually finds a judge who helps her, she sues the deceiver, and she wins.
That's a massive victory for a young woman in that era, to take on the system like that.
It is, and for her, the lifting of that legal burden coincided with the lifting of the spiritual burden. They were intertwined. So she joins the church, then their cousin Helene joins. It's a complete chain reaction.
Okay, so it sounds like a happy ending. Four young women finding purpose, finding community. But there's a villain in the story. Or maybe not a villain, but a clear antagonist.
The father, Pentti Honkonen.
Describe him for us, based on the source.
Pentti is a pillar of his community. He is a lay preacher in the Lutheran church.
Just to clarify for the listeners, what does a lay preacher mean in that Finnish context?
It means he wasn't ordained clergy, he wasn't a paid priest in the formal sense, but he was authorized and respected enough to preach sermons. He was a man of the book. He was the guardian of the family's spiritual heritage.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, the Lutheran Church in Finland isn't just a church. It's a state institution. It's part of the national identity, part of what it means to be Finnish.
So when his daughters start joining this upstart American sect.
It's not just a difference of opinion. In his eyes, it's a betrayal. It's treason against the family, the faith, and even the nation.
The sources mention a letter he wrote.
It's absolutely heartbreaking. He attends one meeting with Ermeli just to see what it's all about. And afterwards, he writes her this letter saying he felt a strange spirit in the room.
Just green spirit.
And he begs them, he pleads with them to burn their books.
Burn the books. Wow. That is such a loaded image. It feels almost medieval. Was he genuinely afraid for them?
I think he was terrified. You have to try and empathize with Pentti's position. He sees his daughters being seduced by a foreign theology. He thinks their eternal souls are at risk. In his mind, he's not being mean. He's trying to save them from what he sees as a dangerous cult.
So how do the sisters react? I mean, in 1970s Finland, patriarchal authority is still a very big deal. You don't just say, no, Dad.
This is the climax of their personal story. This is their moment of truth. They had to make a stand. There is this quote in the memoirs from one of them. If this isn't true, there is no truth.
Wow. If this isn't true, there is no truth. That is absolute, total conviction.
It's the point of no return. They realized that their own spiritual experience, what they felt in their own hearts, in their bones, outweighed their father's authority. They chose this new faith over the old family bond.
That usually leads to permanent estrangement in families.
Usually. And for a while, it was incredibly tense. But this is where the story redeems itself. It took years. But Pentti watched them. He watched their lives unfold.
He looked at the fruit, not the root of the tree.
That's a great way to put it. Exactly. He saw that they were happy, they were moral, they were raising good families. And eventually, over a long period, he softened. He eventually acknowledged they too can be saved.
That's a huge concession for a man with such a rigid theological mind.
It's enormous. And before the parents passed away, the family was fully reunited in love, if not in doctrine. And their story is really a microcosm of what was happening all over Finland at the time.
How so?
The generational friction between the war generation, who held on to tradition as a survival mechanism, and the boomer generation, who were looking for new meaning, for something personal.
It's a beautiful story, but it also highlights the cost. Being a missionary wasn't just about smiling and handing out pamphlets. You were walking right into the middle of these intense family civil wars.
You were the catalyst for the conflict, and that has to take a toll.
Speaking of tolls, let's pivot from the emotional grind to the physical grind. Because while the Honkonen sisters were fighting for their souls, these American missionaries were mostly just fighting to keep their toes attached to their feet.
The logistics of survival were no joke. You have to remember, these are kids from Arizona, Utah, California. I mean, many of them have never seen snow that doesn't melt by noon.
Let's talk about the housing situation. The sources mention these terms, omakotitalo versus tilos. Can you break that down?
Sure. An omakotitalo is a single family home, which was a rare luxury. Most missionaries lived in telos, which are apartments. But we aren't talking modern, insulated apartment complexes.
Right.
These were often older buildings. One missionary, Earl J. Price, was serving in a town called Sainioki. He described sleeping on a literal plywood bed with nothing but a thin rubber pad for a mattress.
My back hurts just hearing that.
And the cold, we keep mentioning it, but it permeated absolutely everything. Many of these apartments didn't have refrigerators.
So where do they put the milk? What do?
They use the Nordic fridge. They had cupboards that were built against the exterior walls of the apartment. The cold radiating through the wall was enough to keep the food from spoiling.
That's ingenious, but it also tells you just how poorly insulated these places were.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole hygiene situation. The sauna. Now, in the U.S., a sauna is something you do for 10 minutes at the gym to feel fancy.
Yeah, it's a luxury.
In Finland, it's life.
Right.
It is an absolute necessity. A lot of these older apartments didn't have showers or even running hot water. The sauna was how you washed yourself.
But it wasn't easy, was it?
Oh, no. You had the bucket run.
The bucket run.
You had to haul water, often from a well outside or maybe a single sink on a different floor. You're carrying these heavy buckets of water to fill the heating tank in the sauna. It was real manual labor just to get clean.
But leave it to a bunch of 19-year-old guys to turn it into a competition. I laughed out loud when I read the competitive sauna story.
Oh, the endurance test. This is classic group psychology. They're sitting in like 180-degree heat, sweat pouring off them, their skin is burning, and nobody wants to be the first one to leave.
Why? Because they're tough. They want to prove they can take it.
No, exactly. It's because if they left, they'd have to go do their work. The source mentions they were trying to outlast each other to avoid sitting down and setting their weekly goals.
You're kidding.
No. As long as they were in the sauna, they weren't accountable. It was a procrastination oven.
That is hilarious. I can't plan my week, Elder. I'm too busy boiling myself alive.
But it also speaks to the camaraderie, you know? They were suffering together. Whether it was the freezing wind on the bikes or the searing heat of the sauna, it created this intense bond.
Speaking of suffering, let's talk about the diet. The sources mentioned a shift that happened in the 70s. They moved from cooking at home to eating in these places called Barry's.
Right. Now, bar is a bit of a false friend in linguistics here. Mm. To an American, a bar is where you get a beer and watch a game. In Finland, a bari was more like a snack bar, a working class diner.
And what was on the menu at these places?
The staple, the absolute go-to was panupivi.
Which is?
A hamburger patty, but not on a bun, just the meat, fried, usually served with a fried egg on top, and beets.
Beets on a hamburger patty. With a fried egg.
It's the Finnish breakfast of champions. Or dinner. Or lunch. It was cheap, it was filling, it was fuel. But the real significance here isn't the culinary delight or lack thereof.
What is it then?
It's the social aspect.
How so?
Well, picture it. You have these baris filled with Finnish laborers, guys in overalls, smoking cigarettes, drinking strong coffee, and in walk two clean-cut Americans in white shirts and ties.
It's a total visual clash.
Completely. But by eating there every day, they normalized their presence. They weren't hiding in their apartments eating peanut butter that their mom sent from home. They were out in the community eating the local food, letting people see them as, well, as people. It broke down a lot of barriers.
Although some of their other choices built barriers. Or at least they built a lot of suspicion. We absolutely have to talk about the Book of Mormon holsters.
This is one of those details that you just can't make up. It's too perfect.
Describe this contraption for us.
Okay, so the missionaries needed to carry books, the Book of Mormon, to give away to people. But briefcases are heavy and they get really slippery on the ice. So someone had the bright idea to invent these underarm holsters.
Like a shoulder holster for a gun.
Exactly like that. They were made of this green plastic fabric. The pocket was square, perfectly sized to fit a paperback book, and you should have one under each arm.
So they're walking around with these noticeable bulges under their suit jackets.
Yes, but they love them for another reason. The plastic acted as a windbreaker. It was an extra layer of insulation for their ribs against that brutal Finnish wind.
Functional fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But it led to a massive misunderstanding, a huge one.
Oh, huge. There's a specific story of a Finnish man in a public restroom. He sees a missionary washing his hands, and the missionary's suit coat falls open. And the guy sees this green harness and what looks like a blocky object tucked under the arm.
He assumes it's a Glock or a pistol of some kind.
Or a Makarov, given the neighborhood. He bolts. He literally runs out of the bathroom, terrified. And this feeds directly into the CIA agent rumors.
Which were rampant at the time, right?
They were absolutely rampant. And we have to put this in context. This is the height of the Cold War. Finland is in this incredibly precarious position, officially neutral, but heavily influenced by the Soviet Union next door.
The policy of Finlandization.
Exactly. So everyone was paranoid about spies. It was a national preoccupation.
And here come these young American men, short haircuts, dark suits, wandering around making maps of neighborhoods, knocking on doors, asking personal questions about families.
And wearing shoulder holsters. It fits the profile perfectly. The Finns were genuinely suspicious. Who are these guys? Are they mapping the territory for an American invasion? Are they CIA?
One missionary, serving in Joensuu, near the eastern border, mentioned he could literally see the Russian watchtowers from his area.
That's how close the tension was. You could see the guard towers. So when the locals accused them of being spies, it wasn't just some crazy conspiracy theory from their perspective. It was a rational fear based on the geopolitical climate they were living in.
So you've got the cold, you've got the beats, you've got the constant suspicion of espionage. And then you have the final boss. The language.
Finnish.
I've heard linguists say that Finnish is one of the hardest languages on earth for an English speaker to learn. It's not Germanic, it's not Latin,
yeah.
It's something else entirely.
It's from the Finno-Ugric language family. It's related to Hungarian and Estonian, and that's about it. It's agglutinative, which means they stick words together to make new meanings. A single Finnish word can be an entire English sentence.
The sources describe the greeny experience. Greeny being the nickname for a brand new missionary. It sounds painful.
It's an infantilizing experience. You are an adult, you're smart, maybe you were a straight-A student in high school. You get to Finland, and suddenly you have the vocabulary and grammar of a toddler. You are memorizing sounds phonetically without having any idea what they mean.
I'm a parrot.
You're a parrot in a suit. There's a really funny anecdote about a pair of missionaries who got kicked out of a house because they spoke Finnish too well.
Wait, that's a bad thing. How does that work?
Well, the host asked how long they'd been in the country. They honestly said 2 months. And the host got angry. He said, "You're lying. Nobody learns Finnish that fast." He assumed they were spies who had been trained for years at Langley, so he threw them out of his house.
Suffering from success.
Yeah.
But then the sources pivot to something deeper regarding language. We start talking about the gift of tongues. Now, usually in a religious context, that sounds mystical or, you know, charismatic. But the way they describe it here feels almost cognitive.
It really does. It touches on what psychologists today might call flow states. You have Jay Wiseman's experience. He's a brand new missionary at a door. A woman asks him a specific, complex theological question.
And he's a greenie. He shouldn't understand it.
No way. He's new. He shouldn't be able to understand her, let alone formulate an answer. But he opens his mouth, and fluent, perfect Finnish comes out. He answers her question perfectly.
Does he even know what he said?
No, that's the wild part. He finishes the sentence, and his conscious brain kind of catches up and goes, "Wait, what did I just say, and what did she ask?" But the connection was made. The message was delivered.
Berggruis talks about something similar. He says he could understand the intent of the person he was talking to, even if he couldn't get the words.
Right. Even when the vocabulary completely failed him, he felt an emotional transfer. He knew what they were worried about. He knew which scripture to turn to, even if he couldn't grammatically explain why he was doing it.
And David Strait, he was forced to be a senior companion, a leader, way too early because of transfers. He's terrified. He doesn't understand the questions people are asking. But the answers just dropped into his head.
They interpreted this as a manifestation of the Holy Spirit, a divine intervention where God makes up the difference between their effort and the requirement of the moment.
From a secular perspective, though,
yeah,
it's absolutely fascinating how the brain operates under that kind of high-stakes pressure and singular focus.
Exactly. When you are that deeply focused, when your purpose is that singular, the brain can sometimes bypass some of the stuttering, self-conscious filters. It accesses patterns and information you didn't even know you'd stored.
Mm.
Whether you call it the spirit or a flow state, the experience for them was real. It gave them the confidence to keep going when, logically, they probably should have just quit.
And a lot of them probably wanted to quit.
Yeah.
Because, and the source is really, really honest about this, most of the time nothing happened.
That's the day-to-day reality. We highlight the exciting stories, but the daily experience was a grind of rejection. Door after door slammed in their faces.
This brings us to a major theme in the sources, this idea of planting versus harvesting.
The delayed gratification theme. And this is so tough for young people. When you're 20 years old, you want to see the result of your work now. You want to see the harvest.
But the sources are just full of these stories where the result took decades to appear. Let's go back to the Berggruis story.
This one is just incredible. He visits a home once. He offers a single prayer with the family. Then he gets transferred or the people move. End of story, right?
It's a failed contact. In his weekly report, that's a zero.
Exactly, a zero. But 40 years later, four decades, he learns that the woman from that family, a woman named Cesar Rahonen, eventually joined the church. And when she was asked why, she said it was because she could never forget how she felt during that one prayer.
So that one moment, 40 years ago, was the seed.
It was the seed. And she grew it on her own for years. It completely reframes what success even means.
And then there's the Darwin Rasmussen story in The City of Ulu.
Yes. He meets an elderly woman who thanks him for knocking until we opened. He's totally confused. He has no memory of her. And she explains that he and his companion had knocked on her door back in 1972.
Okay.
They were completely rejected. But she said their persistence, that willingness to stand there in the cold and not give up, it softened her heart so that when the next pair of missionaries came a year later, she was ready to listen. She left them in.
So he was the battering ram and the next guys were the peace treaty.
That's a perfect way to describe it.
Yeah.
And the sources articulate a philosophy that grows out of this. God doesn't need our perfection. He needs our presence.
I love that. He needs our presence. Just showing up is 90% of the miracle.
It relieves so much pressure. You don't have to be the closer. You don't have to be the hero of every story. You just have to be the one who knocks.
So showing up matters. And sometimes what you show up with is what creates the bridge. We touched on this in the intro, but the role of music in these journals is just huge.
It's huge. Music bypasses the intellect. It bypasses the language barrier. If you can't speak Finnish well, you can still play the piano beautifully.
But sometimes the music was the conflict. We have to tell the Beach Boys story.
This is the story of a man named Jake. Jake was a Finnish musician, a rock star in the local scene, real talent, a real artist.
And rock and roll in the 70s was the absolute currency of cool.
Absolutely. And Jake's band gets the offer of a lifetime. The Beach Boys are touring Finland, and they want Jake's band to be their opening act.
We cannot overstate this. This is the Beach Boys. Good vibrations. Global superstars. Opening for them is the golden ticket. It's the big break.
It's the career maker, but there's a catch. The concert is scheduled for a Sunday.
And Jake had just recently converted to the church.
He was a very new convert, and he had made a personal covenant to keep the Sabbath day holy. In his mind, playing a rock concert, even for the Beach Boys, violated that promise.
So what did he do? This is an impossible choice.
He turned it down?
He said no to the Beach Boys.
He said no. He chose his faith over his big break.
That is, I mean, professionally, that's career suicide. But spiritually?
Spiritually, it became a legend in his family, a founding myth. The source notes that his son later said that that specific decision, that one act of integrity, was the reason that he and his own children all decided to serve missions.
Wow.
It set a standard. The thinking was, Grandpa said no to the Beach Boys for God. I can serve 2 years.
It's that ripple effect again. A sacrifice made in 1973, paying spiritual dividends in 2003.
But then, sometimes music broke down barriers instead of creating these tests of faith. You look at the story of Bruce Schulze and Veli Slagowski.
We were the ones who visited the music teacher, right?
Yes. This teacher was from a very strict religious background, perhaps Listadian or a very strict Lutheran sect, that believed that instrumental music, especially piano music, was sinful, worldly, decadent.
So music itself was the enemy for this person.
Exactly. So what does Elder Slagowski do? He sits down at the man's piano and he plays Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Simon and Garfunkel. Not a hymn.
No, a pop song. But a beautiful, almost spiritual pop song. And he plays it with such feeling, such artistry, that the teacher is just stunned. He's shocked by the beauty of it. And he has this realization. If this music can make me feel this peace, it can't possibly be a sin.
The art transcended the dogma.
Precisely. It opened a door that a theological argument never, ever could have.
And then you have the Honkonen sisters again, our main characters from the beginning, singing on the streets of Helsinki.
This is such a great visual. You have to understand Finnish culture, especially then. It is reserved. It is quiet. You do not make scenes in public. And here are these young women singing religious songs on a street corner.
And they nearly got arrested for it.
The police showed up. They thought it was some kind of protest or a riot starting. But when they got there and realized, oh, they're just singing about Jesus, they let them go. But it shows how countercultural this kind of open exuberance was. To be loud, to be happy, to be public with your faith. That was revolutionary in Helsinki in 1975.
Okay, we've had the heartwarming music segment. Now, as promised, we need to get to the action movie segment.
The Jonsu Prison Escape.
I still can't believe this is in a missionary journal. It sounds like a screenplay.
It's absolutely wild. So you have to set the scene. It's a Friday night in Jonsu. It's dark. It's winter. Elder Roberry and his companions decide to stop by the church to check on things.
And they find the back door is open.
The back door is unlocked and ajar, and they smell tobacco smoke.
Which, in a Mormon chapel, is basically the bat signal that something is seriously wrong.
Exactly. So they go in, they creep quietly toward the kitchen area, and they find a man there. He has piled up all the church's electronics, microphones, speakers, and even the silverware from the kitchen. He's in the middle of a heist.
So what happens? Do they run?
No. Roberry confronts him. The guy turns, gives him this incredibly arrogant look. The source describes it as a nose-in-the-air look. And then he bolts.
And he's not alone.
There's a second guy. They both take off. They run out through a side door called the funeral door.
The funeral door?
Yeah, it's the special side door that's used to bring caskets in and out for funerals. It's a creepy detail, but it just adds to the atmosphere. So they burst out into the snow.
And the missionaries give chase in their suits.
They give chase in knee-deep snow. You have these young guys in suits and dress shoes sprinting through snowdrifts after prison escapees.
And they actually catch one of them.
They tackle one of them at a fence. They physically pin him down in the snow and hold him there until the police arrive.
Sursky and Hutch have nothing on these elders.
But the twist is what happens next. The courtroom drama. They get subpoenaed to testify. Rauberry has to identify the one who got away, a guy named Pete Lanen, who was a known prison escapee.
And how does he identify him?
By that nose-in-the-air tick. He remembered the specific arrogance of the look the guy gave him in the kitchen. It's such a specific human detail that makes the story real.
It's incredible. But the deep dive gives us a perfect counterbalance to this. We have the tackle the prisoner story, and then we have the Rihimeki prison miracle. This one is less action movie, more redemption.
It is. It shows a complete other side of the coin. You have visionaries in a different town, and they want to show films to prisoners. They have a projector and some wholesome movies, Run Dick, Run Jane, which was a fitness film, and a basketball movie.
Not exactly the Shawshank Redemption, but it's entertainment.
Right. They go to the prison gate. The guard takes one look at them, scoffs, and slams the door in their face. Go away.
Which is pretty standard procedure, I'd imagine. You don't just walk into a prison with a film projector.
But they don't give up. They go into town. They meet a man. They start chatting. They tell him their story about being rejected at the prison. And the man smiles and says, go back tomorrow. I am the boss.
It's the warden.
It's the warden. But here is the why. Why does he let them in? It wasn't because he was a huge fan of basketball movies.
Why then?
He tells them a story. When he was a little boy, years and years before, he was poor. He was hungry. And an American family, the family of the very first mission president in Finland, Henry Mattis, had lived nearby. And they had fed him. They had been kind to him when he was just a hungry nobody kid.
The bread cast upon the waters returns decades later.
Exactly. Because of that kindness decades earlier, he opens the prison gates to this new generation of missionaries. They end up showing the films to 250 hardened criminals. It goes so well, the story gets out, and they end up showing them to 2,000 students in the local schools.
All because a family was nice to a hungry kid in the 1950s.
It just reinforces that central theme. You never, ever know which small action is the one that's going to matter.
That connects really well to the dreams and visions theme we see running through the sources.
Yeah.
There's a lot of unexplained phenomena, stuff that borders on the supernatural.
There is. And even if you are a complete skeptic, you have to appreciate the psychological potency of these dreams for the people experiencing them.
Give us an example.
A woman named Anne Torpo. She has a dream of a family dressed in all white, standing by a baptismal font. She sees their faces clearly. Later, she meets a family that exactly matches the description from her dream. That vision kept her going when they weren't interested at first.
It's like a premonition. It tells her, don't give up on these people.
In Velirut Salainen, he dreams of two men standing on a hill, handing him a package of great value. So when the missionary's two men in suits walk up to his house on a hill, the recognition is instant. His son actually asked his dad, are they gods?
Wow.
It suggests that for these people, the conversion experience wasn't just an intellectual argument. It was happening in their subconscious. It felt destined. It lowered their natural defenses because they felt like they had seen this happen before.
Now, all of this activity, the chases, the dreams, the day-to-day grind, was happening under a specific leadership. We need to talk about the mission president, Robert G. Wade. He looms large in these journals.
He really does. He defines the Wade era. And his leadership style was unique. He wasn't a drill sergeant. He wasn't focused on numbers. He was more of a spiritual coach.
He used the Benjamin Franklin method. I found this fascinating just as a self-improvement tactic.
It's a classic. Benjamin Franklin famously tried to achieve moral perfection by focusing on one virtue a week, temperance, silence, order, and so on. President Wade adapted this. He had the missionaries pick one attribute to perfect each day.
So today I am going to be perfectly honest, or today I am going to be perfectly diligent.
Right. It broke down the overwhelming task of being a good person into manageable 24-hour chunks. It focused on character development, not just baptism statistics.
But he also had to deal with the messy real-world problems. There's the story about the check theft.
This just shows the level of responsibility these kids were given. A postal inspector contacts the mission office. Checks sent from parents back in the U.S. to their missionary sons were being stolen from the mail. A federal crime.
And Wade wasn't there.
He was traveling, so the mission secretary, Elder Rauberry, the same guy who tackled the prisoner, by the way, he had to handle this federal investigation. He's 20 years old, and he's working with postal inspectors to set up a sting operation to catch a mail thief.
It forced them to grow up incredibly fast.
In a hurry, and we can't forget the other half of that leadership team, Sister Wade.
Mission mother.
In an environment that was so cold, so harsh, and so male-dominated, she provided the softness. The journals are filled with memories of her making waffles for the missionaries.
Waffles seem to be a recurring positive memory in these sources.
It's comfort food. It's a taste of home. She managed a mission home that was full of her own young children, all while missionaries were traipsing through, teaching investigators in her living room. She grounded the experience. She reminded them that they were part of a family, not just an army.
So we've looked at the leaders, the chaos, the culture. Let's zoom in on a couple of specific golden converts. These are the big success stories that kept them going when all the doors were slamming in their faces.
Amo Ohala is a real standout for me.
The jogger.
They meet him while he's out for a run in a park. He tries to blow them off immediately. He says, "Look, I'm a bachelor. I'm busy. I have nothing to offer your church."
But the missionaries felt something different.
The source calls it a blood of Israel intuition, a spiritual prompting. They just felt they absolutely had to go back and visit him, so they drop off a Book of Mormon.
Yeah, he actually reads it.
He reads the whole thing, cover to cover, between their first and second visit. That is over 500 pages of dense King James-style English or the Finnish translation. So when they came back, the missionary decided to test him.
A pop quiz.
Basically, a friendly one. He asked, "So what was your favorite part?" expecting a vague, general answer. But Ohala starts talking in detail about the stones of Jared, the specific glowing stones that were used to light the barges in the book. It's a deep cut. It's not the main story.
He wasn't faking it. He'd done the reading.
He was all in. He represented the intellectual convert, the one who engaged with the text and was won over by the ideas.
But then there's Sister Kupako, and her story is... it's much heavier. It's not about intellect. It's about sheer survival.
It is. She was found via a comeback card, a little record of a previous visit that had been thrown away by other missionaries.
And it mysteriously reappeared in the stack they were using.
Right. It just showed up. So they go back to the address, and they find a woman in a truly desperate situation. Her husband is abusive. He threatens the missionaries.
That's a dangerous household to even visit.
Very. But she is looking for a lifeline. She sees the church not just as a theology, but as a literal way out of the darkness of her life. The detail that just stays with me is her baptism.
Describe it for us.
She shows up to be baptized wearing a pair of dark sunglasses.
Indoors.
Indoors. To hide the two black eyes her husband had given her for her decision.
That is just heartbreaking.
But it's also incredibly empowering. In that moment, she was reclaiming her life. And it highlights that for many... like the Mumus, the war widows, and women like Sister Kupako, the church was a refuge. It was a place where they were treated with dignity and respect, perhaps for the first time in years.
So it wasn't just about saving souls. It was about saving lives, literally.
Absolutely. It provided a community that could protect them and give them strength.
So what does this all mean? We've covered so much ground, from freezing saunas to prison breaks to waffle breakfasts. What's the big takeaway?
I think it really comes down to a few core lessons.
Yeah.
First, the power of just showing up. Success wasn't linear. It wasn't about numbers. It was about planting seeds, like that single prayer with Caesarionin that might not bloom for 40 years.
And the connection between people.
Yeah.
That Finnish sisu, that grit we talked about. The missionaries had to have it to endure the cold and the constant rejection, but the converts had it too.
Oh, the converts had it in spades. Think about the Honkonen sisters standing up to their father. Think about Sister Kupako walking into that baptismal font. It took immense courage to join a strange American church in 1970s Finland. You risked social ostracism. You risked war with your own family. You had to have sisu to step into that water.
It required a deep resilience on both sides.
Yeah.
And it clearly created this unbreakable bond. You see these Americans, decades later, writing these memoirs, and they're still weeping over these memories.
They left a piece of their hearts in the snow.
I want to leave our listeners with one final image from the sources. It's a metaphor that I think applies to everyone, whether you're a missionary in Finland or just trying to get through the week. It's the story of the broken spoke.
Ah, yes. The bicycle metaphor.
A missionary was riding his bike. He noticed one spoke was broken, and he thought, it's just one spoke. I have 30 others. It'll be fine. So he ignored it.
A classic mistake. We've all done it.
He kept riding. The pressure from that one missing spoke redistributed to the others. Then ping, another spoke snapped. Then the wheel started to wobble. It was rubbing against the brake pads, slowing him down.
And then the crash.
He hit a patch of cobblestones in the town of Tornio. The weakened wheel collapsed into a taco shape, and he went flying over the handlebars.
It's the perfect metaphor for maintenance. Spiritual, mental, physical, anything. You ignore the small flaws, the little compromises, the little dishonesties, the thing you know you should fix, and you think you're fine. But the whole system is weakening. And eventually, you hit the cobblestones of life, and it all falls apart.
Don't ignore the broken spoke. Fix it while the wheel is still round.
That's good advice for bikes and for life.
And finally, we have to mention the backdrop to all of this. The Northern Lights. The Finns call them Revanchalit.
The sources describe them so beautifully. Sometimes they were terrifying. Some missionaries actually thought they were a sign of the Second Coming because the colors were so red and violent.
But mostly, they were just awe-inspiring.
Green, purple, dancing across the entire night sky. It's a great visual for the whole mission experience itself. It was cold, it was dark, it was often scary. But it was punctuated by these moments of absolute, undeniable, breathtaking light.
That is a beautiful place to end it. Whether you're braving the frozen streets of your own life, fighting off a prison escapee, or just trying to fix a broken spoke.
Yeah.
Remember, sometimes just showing up is the miracle.
And watch out for the green plastic holsters.
Always watch out for the holsters. Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll catch you next time.